This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Maury.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Maury, last week you were telling us about the Environment Network Manawatu, all the sorts of diverse activities they're involved in or they support. What about your particular area itself, the things that you are doing?
Yeah, so I suppose this year that's kind of quite interesting. Every year is a little bit different from the other. One of my key roles is to organise networking hui in our group, which I mentioned before. So for anyone involved in community food sovereignty activities, it's really important we give them opportunities to come together to share what they're doing with other people involved in that sector, sometimes give them some kind of upskilling and interesting information that's happening, and also just provide them an opportunity to talk to each other.
Upskilling.
So sometimes we'll run, like, for example, this year, the next hui, which is in March, I'm looking at a focus around community gardens and people involved in community gardens, and I was going to run a little seminar on effective seed saving. So again, that kind of fits in with what I was saying last week about our seed exchange library. So there's differences between kind of how you might save tomato seeds from bean seeds, for example. The tomatoes you kind of get wet and kind of want to dry out on the thing, where the beans you just leave to dry. So, giving some people some, I suppose, extra information to do what they do more effectively.
So for these hui, is it a half-day thing, and one day, or over a weekend?
Most of the ones I run are just a one day, and I normally try and do it within school hours. So it's kind of 4 or 5 hours between 10 and 2 o'clock is my typical timing. This year we're looking at running the first one over in Kelvin Grove Community Hall, which is a lovely community centre we used for the first time at the end of last year. And a typical session might involve an hour of people kind of letting each other know who they are, which groups they work for, what's interesting to them at the moment. We'll often have a couple of kind of speakers talking about particular projects or things that are happening in the region. We then have a free lunch, so that's always a good motivator to get people to come along. Which is either kind of made through volunteers, or we use some of our operating budget to pay for. And then in the afternoon we try and have some kind of engaging small group activities. So some examples are, I think last year I ran an activity where I got people to think of an idea and then write a funding application for it, which sounds really boring, but the Environmental Initiative funding, which is something our organisation offers to the community, is can be a bit of a challenge for people to kind of get to the point of thinking of the idea through to writing it down and actually applying for it. So through the process of getting people to do that in a small group in a fun way, they kind of got something at the end. And I think from the 6 groups, we actually had a couple groups that went on and actually used that as a basis for a real life funding opportunity afterwards. So kind of trying to do something a bit fun and to engage communities.
They tend to apply for funding rather than try to fundraise?
They do both, to be honest. So so within our group at the moment, within Environment Network Manawatu, our Environmental Initiative funds, we have a couple of different levels. One of them is up to $1,000 that anyone can apply for, any individuals, all throughout the year, and that just gets used as a kind of a reimbursement. So people tend to pay for things, keep the receipts, and we can reimburse them if it's a project we've approved and meets our criteria. So it's something that aligns with one of our 4 PO in our strategic plan. The other level is a $15,000 one, so that's quite a bigger one, and that can be for, has to be for organisations. And again, there's a bit more criteria.
When you say organisation, you mean registered?
Has to be. I think effectively has to be an organisation that holds its own bank account under its own name, and which typically tends to be a registered organisation. And again, that's up to $15,000, which is quite significant, and that can cover costs of staffing as well as materials, resources, and that's open once a year and happens to be open at the moment.
You get many applications for these things?
We do. I'm pretty sure we always have the money fully allocated. We do get a lot of applications. It does go up and down a bit year by year. It's one of the main, as everyone knows, for non-for-profits it's quite hard to get funding, so it's really nice to have this money that we've got that's earmarked for our particular region for environmental matters.
And so for the groups, it's quite competitive, is it? There's if you could fund all of them, you'd need three or four times as much as they're applying for?
Yes. I suppose yes and no. It's one of those funny things. A lot of our groups have regular funding channels where they'll be kind of applying year on year for funds, and that's again within talk of our organisation and others. There's a strong, I think, desire to have the general funding systems overhauled a bit, because there's a bit of a tendency for people to fund things just for a year, always fund whatever's new and shiny, and not have any kind of long term continuation of funding. That's right. So that's something that we're always.
Well, also the admin. You said you fund some of the admin as well.
We can. Well, that was a bit of an idea. It's not something that's kind of really happening at the moment. It's more just an informal. We're always there to have a chat if we need to, but we don't tend to do any books or things on other organisations' behalf. But we were looking at it as a potential kind of asking our member groups again. We often go to our member groups, say, "Hey, what are we doing well? What could we do differently?" And that was something we were investigating at some stage, but don't think anything's really happened for that at the moment.
Just, do you find, from what I hear generally, is there a problem getting, say, people to fulfil the treasurer and secretary roles and things for organisations?
Well, luckily for us, so ENM is, we do have a board, which I think is currently 7 or 8 people, and people come and go, but generally we've had more people applying for vacancies on the board than there are positions, which has been really good. There's always people who are really interested there. Other smaller, so some of our member groups who we support, I know some of them do have trouble getting people on their boards. It can be quite hard. So again, that's something we can help them with. We use our communications to advertise positions as they come up and try and motivate people in the public to be involved.
Okay. And these are mainly retired people, you think, doing that? If you have during school time, then
I think most of the our board, for example, I think operate after hours in terms of when people are there. And just kind of looking at our board members here, I would say there's probably only two of the 8 people, I'd say, were over 50. There's one person who's definitely in their 20s, probably several in their 30s. In 40, so it's kind of a bit of a range there. I'd say we do quite well where we are, and we have a youth member, so I think we have a specific spot on our board that we always try and make sure is open for someone who's quite young to be able to fill that spot. So,
and that would reflect the participants. Well, you're more a board and then various paid people, aren't you?
So the board members are unpaid, they're volunteers, I gather, whereas I'm a staff member, so we have And the way the structure works is the board members kind of decide our overall direction of things. They talk to the general manager, who's my boss, who's a full-time staff member, and she directs me and my other colleagues and what we do in terms of the day-to-day running.
Okay. Is there a sort of career path in that for people? How did you get into it?
That's an interesting question. I think there is. I didn't take what would be the normal career path, I'd say. As I mentioned briefly before, I have a very odd career path of my own. I left high school and joined the Air Force, following in the footsteps of my older brother. So I ended up being an avionics technician in the Air Force for 7 years, and then met my wife, who is a staunch pacifist. And so, given where I'm operating now, you can probably tell who won that argument. I moved down here and then went to Massey and did a science degree in zoology and ecology. And at the same time as kind of having the family with my wife, also did a 1-year teaching diploma in primary, and then went in between looking after kids at home and kind of managing a bit of the family farm. Ended up teaching at a Montessori early childhood centre for 4 years, a local one. So that was really lovely, and I went along there with my daughter at the time. And funnily enough, talking about career progression, that was a hard thing to do as a early childhood teacher, is to get kind of career progression. And so ended up hitting my head against the brick wall a bit to kind of get to look at paying conditions. And so this job happened to open up.
Hoping to be an early childhood teacher.
It was really fun at the time, but it was probably wasn't really quite a long term goal of mine. I've always been really interested in the environment.
Well, one of the issues is the limited number of men in, well, even primary, but certainly early childhood. So weren't they crying out to keep you in there?
I think I had a couple of times someone refer to me as a golden unicorn, given I was a male early childhood teacher with kind of science and being able to speak today on Māori. But at the end end of the day, given a lot of it is run by private sector, and there's no, it's a really tough area for paying conditions, and being a kind of, as I say, a kind of like a privileged white male, if I'm not able to advocate for myself for paying conditions, you can imagine
a white
what
male
like.
Who speaks Te Reo Māori.
So that's another, I suppose, another a bit of a string to my bow, is that all of my children have gone through the local kura here, Te Kura Kaupapa Māori or Manawatū.
Okay.
So they've all had, they can all
speak. So your wife Māori. Is Māori?
No, we're both Pakeha. So that's a kind of, again, a bit of an interesting kind of, I suppose, based on kind of a social justice perspective. My wife comes from a kind of like a Quaker background, where they talk about living your values, and as Pakeha New Zealanders, I think it's really important to uphold Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and one of the ways we can do that is being able to try and walk the walk as opposed to talking the talk. And luckily
does that mean your children are getting both cultures if they're going
absolutely. They're getting both, they're getting our culture at home, and it's again one of those funny things we hear people say, oh, but if it's an immersion Māori, how will they learn English? You always learn the dominant culture of what's happening locally, and so we think it's really important that they be able to get a good grounding in history. And it's been wonderful seeing them thrive going to kura there, being involved in the whānau there. It's opened up a whole new world to us that we never would have had access to otherwise.
Okay. And how were you received there then?
Very, very openly. It's nothing but aroha. We had a, I think back when we first had our children, our first steps were, we went to Te Wānanga to kind of take them to do one of the 1 year, I think level one to, Māori courses there, and met some lovely people, and one of them happened to mention, because we had our babies along with us at the time, I think we had like a 3-year-old and maybe a 1-year-old, they said, oh, have you ever thought of going to Kōhanga? And at the time we thought, oh, no, but we're Pākehā, we can't, can we? And they were like, no, you can, anyone can. And so they were really lovely. They introduced us to the to some of the staff at Te Urukaraka Kōhanga Reo, which is the Kōhanga up at Massey there, went to do a visit and enrolled there. And so at that time our kids, who I think were maybe kind of 4 and 1 perhaps, we went along there, they said they had an open door policy, and I took them up, and I think I went full time with them for about the first 6 months and learned a lot there. And they said, oh, we've never had anyone take up our policy as much as you did there going along. I had a solid grounding in kind of immersion to there by going along there, and that was probably the start of my journey. And as they came
to
school,
best way to learn a language, isn't it?
Absolutely. And when they came to school age, they said, well, here are your options. You can go to a normal school and these bilingual units, but actually there's a couple of really good local Māori immersion schools. So again, we did the tunnel, the visits there, went along and chose to send our children there. So that's been absolutely wonderful.
That's a bit of a digression, but
that actually started off as what was the career progression into what I did. So as I say, so that funnily enough, at so I finished teaching as an early childhood centre, as a Montessori teacher there, and it just so happened that a friend of ours was employed in Environment Network Manawatū, but in the position I'm in now, and she was having to leave to go to a different location in New Zealand, and so this job opportunity came up. And at the time, I think I'd applied to Horizons for some jobs more, I suppose, aligned with my degree in terms of zoology and ecology and kind of in the environment, doing kind of fish monitoring type things. And I think there was quite a lot of graduates who were applying for very few jobs at the time, so that was a bit tricky. And when this job came up, my wife said, oh, you should apply for it. And I was like, oh, I don't really know, I don't think it's quite me. But she kind of convinced me to apply for it, and obviously interviewed it, and kind of that was about 4 years ago, so I'm still here now. And I've absolutely loved it. It's again, maybe not quite as aligned with my degree in the zoology and ecology, but it is very aligned with my values in terms of being able to grow my own food at home. That's something we do naturally, and actually just the networking side of bringing people together and supporting them is something I really love. I suppose so. That was my path, which I say is a bit unusual, but we do work closely with Massey, and this is a whole other tangent I can go down. But Massey have a number of programs here that are quite relevant. So they do a Masters of Sustainable Development Goals, and so they have graduates there who come out with those qualifications. They'll be very suited here, and I think they're just looking at the moment at doing a couple of new types of papers in environmental sustainability. So again, that's the
do you get them doing projects with you as part of their study?
We kind of do. We actually get them to come and intern for us. So the last couple of years we've had the master students come and spend think normally about 6 weeks with us. So basically they're interning, we get a good volunteer, and often we try and set them quite a specific project. So as an example, the last person that came through, we got them to look at the carbon, I suppose the carbon use of our organisation across a number of different areas, and how that works out, and how we're mitigating it through kind of like the work with supporting our member groups. So that was that was really fascinating this year. I think we're hoping to get someone to help me develop a how-to compost guide for our local communities, of getting people to learn how to compost properly. So so it's really useful for us. They get some on the ground experience of what's happening, and we get to use their skills and knowledge to help us for a few weeks. So I mean, I suppose I could expand actually with Massey there again, kind of being in Palmerston North and being a university town. There's a few areas where we've collaborated with them. They've written a couple of articles on some work we've done in the past. So in my area, the food resilience area, there was a strategy we actually wrote about 3 or 4 years ago called the 4412 Kai Resilience Strategy. And so this was a quite a big document and the four four one two and I say it without thinking, but the 4412 is a postcode area of Palmerston North, and it includes the suburbs of kind of Takaroa, West End, Highbury, and so what's considered kind of maybe a bit more of the poorer areas of Palmerston North, where there is more food insecurity. And so during the COVID times, 2020 2021, they realised that there was quite a big need in this area, and so they went about developing a strategy based on talking to people in the community about what were the issues they were experiencing right now, what they saw as potential solutions, and what was needed. And so the strategy was really based in kind of community-led development, what's happening in the community, what they could do to support it. And that was something that we worked in with a group called Aura Connect to provide and support and kind of inform what we then did over the next several years in terms of what projects we were supporting, what we were doing to kind of make sure we could kind of improve the situation to do with food sovereignty in that area.
Do you see what you're doing as band-aid or long-term strategy?
It's both. And I suppose a good way is to use a couple of analogies, but then also pull them apart. So you've probably heard of the analogy, if you give a person a fish, you'll feed them for a day. If you teach them how to fish, you'll feed them for a lifetime. So that's really
There's another one. Nice. You teach them to fish and they'll never work again.
That's true. Yeah. But I suppose looking at the environmental lens, what if you teach them how to fish, but actually there's no fish in the river because it's polluted? What if you have requirements that they need a fishing license and they don't have enough money for it? So kind of an analogy you can take further to show that actually it is problematic, and just it's not always as easy as just saying teach them how to fish. And so obviously if there's people who are in dire need of food, it's no good giving them seeds and saying, here you go, plant some seeds, grow some food, because they're hungry now. They might not have any experience in growing their own food, and you're setting them up to fail. And so kind of what I see is what we're doing is it's actually a real continuum from band-aid in terms of immediate need, which is what a lot of the I'd say the food support services like Methodist Social Services, Salvation Army, a lot of the free food do, but also keeping an eye on the long term. And so that's where I think where my real passion is the kind of food sovereignty. How do we set up systems? How do we support people to be able to do things for themselves? And so that's where the community gardens, the support for people growing food in their own homes, I think is really powerful to enable them to kind of do that themselves.
Well, also, I think the cooking, isn't it? Are you involved in that?
I'm not involved personally. I mean, personally, I probably do 92% of the cooking at home. My older daughter's actually coming, is getting quite good now and is doing some things, but I do most of the cooking at home, but I don't do cooking. I leave that to the experts at Super Grand. They do a lot of that. But it's definitely, as you say, kind of, teach a person how to fish, but if you don't teach them how to cook a fish, again, it's kind of, a continuum. There's a lot of education, and education, I think, is a really strong thing that comes in with our organisation. And I know...
are people looking to learn those things?
I think they are. And I think there's some who are, but there's also some who aren't even aware of how powerful it can be to learn those. Yes. And so that's a big something we're working on is our communications, getting out to the public. And we've got a really lovely comms lead at the moment who's really good at engaging people out in the public, letting them know about what we're doing and kind of how they can be involved. So there's it's about getting the message out there, getting people enthused and to come along, and then also making sure we can then provide them with opportunities or support our member groups who are providing people in the public with those opportunities to. So there's, as I say, there's so much work out there. Messi, again, working with Messi, they've done some research with us. We've also worked in with them lately to do a bit of a look at food sovereignty in our area. What does food sovereignty mean to the Manawatū in particular?
Can you define that term?
So the food sovereignty is kind of setting up systems where people have obviously the access to nutritious and culturally appropriate food and have agency over the food systems that produce it. And so as part of this project here, we identified several prominent people in our area who work in food sovereignty. So Beth Lou, who you might know, is really strong there. We talked to some people from Te Aotearoa. I think we talked to Kylie Phillips from Te Pātakakai 4412.
So what are they doing that makes them prominent?
Well, I say prominent just that they're people who are really putting a lot of time and effort in. So Beth Lou, for example, is a volunteer. Of Let's Grow Palmy and GGAC, Growing Gardens and Communities. And so she saw a need quite a few years ago that people didn't know how to grow food at home. And so she set up Growing Gardens and Communities as a way to kind of encourage people and support people to grow food at home. So this is a really, I suppose, interesting example of a specific idea that was from a person in the community. She was doing it and having some volunteers come along to help her. So they would get a trailer with compost and some plants and some wooden boxes they'd use to pop into the ground to set up garden beds in people's homes. So I think they were doing kind of maybe one or two kind of every few weeks there.
Okay.
We managed to get some funding through Kāinga Ora and Horizons. And so for the last 2 or 3 years, unfortunately it's not happening right now, but for the last 2 or 3 years we had got funding. We were able to employ someone. So every Tuesday or every Thursday we would go along and put in a couple of garden. We put in 3 garden beds in 2 different people's homes a week. And so I think we had gotten up to somewhere between 200 and 300 homes that she had helped in that program there. So it made a real significant impact.
Now, I know people who can afford to put in those sort of the raised beds and so on to grow vegetables, but it's not that cheap for them. So is it actually an economic venture?
Well, it depends on how you use them. So kind of an interesting little project. So if you went along to Bunnings or Mitre 10 and brought something that's pre-made, it would cost... Yeah. quite likely could cost you a few $100s, but again, if you go around town, you might notice that there's often pallets left at the end of driveways of industrial centres. And so something we did a while ago was create a little Facebook video on how you can turn a pallet into a garden bed using just kind of some simple tools and a few nails and things. And so that's something that people can do, and we've provided some resources, as I say, the video to let people know how they do that. But the other thing is in industry, there's a thing called pallet collars, which are these wooden kind of collars that go around standard-sized pallets.
Yeah.
And often they're used in for transporting farm machinery and large items overseas to Palmerston North and back again. And luckily, we've got a good contact at Vesta Wind Farms here, and so they were able to provide us with normally a couple dozen of these every month or so that we were able to use to immediately put in the ground as garden beds. So there's so again, kind of working with local businesses to kind of source that material is a really kind of, I suppose,
which is your circular style instead of things going to waste. They can
absolutely and I suppose using not quite a fancy term, but kind of resource brokering is kind of something that we do. Like if we find a good source of something that we know is really useful in the community and it's free, we will kind of happily try and organise to take that and then pass that on to our member groups. So the pallet collars was a really strong example of that. I suppose going back to the original with Beth Lou and the Growing Gardens and Communities and other various people. Yeah. So part of the Messi collaboration was kind of introducing them to these people in the community. The lovely people from Messi, Angelique Liberty and Chrissy Severinson would talk to these people, interviewing them and find out what was really important. And often they got some interesting differences, but also some similarities between people of what is important to do with food sovereignty. And as a kind of like a final as a final part of the puzzle, they employed a researcher to look at food sovereignty as a whole and do a bit of a literature review in New Zealand and locally about what is food sovereignty, what does it mean to people, how can we kind of improve it. And so we're at the final kind of getting near the final point of the study where we've actually employed a famous national artist called Toby Morris, who you might have heard of on the spin-off. He does really good cartoons, often actually quite often to do with some food sovereignty issues, but we've got him at the moment doing a series for us to create kind of like a little poster or a website that we can use to kind of promote okay. food sovereignty, talk about it, and get people really interested in it as a subject and what we can do. So that's something
okay.
that will hopefully be released at one of the HUI that I'm going to be organising later this year.
Very good. Do you get the social policy people involved at all?
Who do you mean by social policy?
Out of Mercy, the social policy stuff.
Occasionally, we try and... We've got links in various places. There, obviously, yeah. as an environmental organisation, we've got a few links in the, I think the Natural Resources Department, yes, that yeah, we're used yeah. to do ecology and zoology, talk to them with some of the programmes that are doing the biodiversity enhancement protection. I've got the links, and I think it's the School of Health and the people I'm talking to actually there. So it kind of does vary. We've been involved with Massey when we did the Sustainable Development Goals Symposium last year. So we worked in with them to kind of help get that get up and running. So yeah, there's quite a few links there.
How do you see your work developing in future? You got particular policies or directions in mind?
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of, I suppose part of what I work on is from our strategic plan, which is something that's been kind of developed by our board and kind of and all of our member groups, and everyone's had some input in it. So within my particular area, which is community food sovereignty, one of the big areas is looking more to expand our network to include primary producers and businesses. So just as a bit of a context, what I was saying before, a lot of the people we work with are from social service organisations, kind of like the bottom of the cliff type stuff, helping people there. But the food system is really huge, and the food system, obviously, when we think about supermarket chains, the growers, the farmers, the people out there are a hugely important part of that, the most important part, I'd say. Yeah. And obviously, you'll hear about tensions between the whole kind of rural-urban divide, and a lot of people don't think of kind of environmentalism as going in hand-to-hand with farmers, but there's actually a lot of collaboration and a lot of crossover there. And so one of our goals is to work in more and expand our network to include farmers. An example of that is this year, the second HUI I'm running this year is going to be a one-day conference at the Palmerston North Event Centre talking about food futures, building a climate-resilient food system. So kind of really trying to bridge the gap between what we're trying to do in the environment, food, kind of localized food, but also kind of making sure that we've got the primary producers, farmers involved in the conversations and giving opportunity for whether it's people from Massey or whether it's organizations that run kind of biodynamic farming courses, giving them opportunity to talk to the people who are on the ground doing the work of growing the food, giving them the kind of best information they can.
This is part 2 of 3. Listen next week for part 3. Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.